Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I was going to tell you we had two national heavyweights here today, including Dr. Otis Brawley, who is the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society. However, Dr. Brawley has not made it to the program today, so I want to apologize for that. Instead, we have the second heavyweight, Dr. Gilbert Welch of the Dartmouth Institute of Health Policy and Clinical Research. He's also author of Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in Pursuit of Health. So when we discuss the evidence and logic for recent changes that have gone on and suggestions for monitoring or screening for breast and prostate cancer, screening seems like it's just a no-brainer. But is it? When is screening for disease perhaps not such a good idea? That's kind of where we're going to be going today. If you've got questions or comments, you can reach us at Anchorage at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, as always, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Welch, it's a real pleasure to have you in front of me.
It is great to be back in Alaska.
So you've been here before.
I have. Some 30 years ago, I was a general medical officer for the Indian Health Service out in Bethel, where I'm headed after I finish talking to you.
And you're coming back because you're going to do some programs, talks, is that right?
That's right. I'll be speaking at ANMC on Thursday, and also giving a talk for the general public on Thursday at 5:30 at the
Wendy Williamson.
Thank you.
Auditorium. So, and I should say that because of that, because of UAA's support for that programming and for us, that we should mention that UAA is a nonprofit contributor to KSKA programming as well.
Okay.
And you work at Dartmouth.
Yes, I do.
And tell us a little bit about what you do there. What's going on at Dartmouth we need to know about?
Yeah, well, Dartmouth is, first I work for a research shop called the Dartmouth Institute for Health Policy and Clinical Practice. And what we do there, we're epidemiologists, and epidemiologists classically study the patterns of disease. But for the last 20, 30 years, we've been studying the patterns of U.S. medical care. We've been very interested in the epidemiology of U.S. medical care, how different parts of the country get very different amounts of medical care. And this raises questions like which rate is right and who's getting what and why and how sensible is our current healthcare system. So we've been very engaged in health policy issues about the volumes of care in different parts of the country. And, my mentor is Jack Wenberg, who's been doing this kind of geographic analyses for about 30 years. So we're asking hard questions about our own profession. We're physicians. I'm a conventionally trained physician. I'm a believer in healthcare for the sick. It's done, I think American medicine can do some very good things. But at the same time, we can have too much medical care, and that's been a very big concern for us.
I want to get back to what you're doing specifically, but I was going to ask you after the program about Dr. Wenberg in particular. So he's the one who's brought out the fact that there's a lot of differences in quality and cost, and that those two don't have much correlation.
Don't have much to do with each other. That's right. And that we're really concerned about the problem of too much medical care, where there mm-hmm. really are parts of the mm-hmm. country where there's too much hospitalization going on, too much elective surgery, and it's a pretty wild system out there right now.
Do other countries have the same issue?
They have some of the same issues. We're a couple standard deviations away from the mean in the United States, but it's certainly not a problem that's unique to the United States, but we're really at an extreme.
Mm-hmm. And we have a unique healthcare system compared to everybody else, which makes you wonder if the two are related.
Yeah, some would say we don't have a real system. We have sort of a more haphazard, sort of wild free-for-all. But that said, sometimes it still performs quite well, but there are certain areas where, excessive things happen.
Let me remind listeners again, if you've got questions or comments during the next hour or so, our local number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. So one other thing I wrote down after reading your book as well is it comes to my mind that, you know, our healthcare system now has been trying more and more to move from treatment of disease and illness. We're getting pushed to do prevention of disease and illness. And so I wrote, is this a good idea? Does this help us get into this issue?
Yeah, I think it's a good place to start. And I think the answer is it depends. And I think your listeners should be clear that the word prevention, spans a whole lot of different activities in the healthcare system. And I like to think of it as having two important buckets that are very, very different. One is health promotion. And that is about encouraging people to do things that you know are good for their health. And I liken it to things your grandmother would have told you. Don't smoke, eat your fruits and vegetables, and go play outside. Stay active, move around. Those are really important ideas and very important to people's health. But when prevention got medicalized, about the time I was in medical school in the late 70s, all of a sudden there became a great interest in early detection. And that's very, very different than health promotion. That's about looking hard at well people, trying to find things wrong with them. And over the past 10, 20 years, our ability to find things wrong with people has increased exponentially. Our ability to detect small biochemical changes, our ability to see small structural abnormalities has led us now to realize that, virtually all of us harbor some abnormalities. And that means when we start looking hard at people, we can find a lot of things wrong, and yet we really don't know for which people those things are actually going to be important or not. So our standard approach is to intervene on everybody, and that creates problems of its own. It's a side effect of looking for early forms of disease. We end up treating people who can't benefit because actually they were never going to experience the problem.
So if you tell somebody to eat better, exercise more,
side effects to that.
Yeah, yeah. Or not likely. And we know pretty well that that has good outcomes health-wise.
Absolutely.
But when you do a PSA, now things that algorithm changes.
Things get a little bit more complicated. Yeah, if we relentlessly trying to find early forms of disease, we end up finding them in almost virtually everybody. And then we don't never know which people that information is going to be relevant for, so we tend to start treating everybody. And that's led to, very high rates of medication and a lot of surgeries going on in people who are well.
And there are consequences sometimes.
There are real consequences.
Both good and bad.
Yeah, and sometimes the good ones are... don't really seem to appear when you study the problem carefully. I think real questions have been raised, particularly in prostate and breast cancer screening, as to how much it's really helping people. Mm-hmm. It's no question it's hurting some people. Yeah. And that's a hard thing to say. I don't really enjoy being the bearer of that kind of news, but prostate cancer screening is really a poster child for the problem of overdiagnosis. 20 years ago, a, quote, simple blood test was developed that could detect small changes, small meaning nanograms per milliliter, changes in antigen called prostate-specific antigen. And 20 years later, it looks like about 1 million men have been treated unnecessarily for prostate cancer. And it's no picnic. I mean, that's a big surgery. The prostate's not easy to get to. There are real side effects to the procedure. There are even a few deaths, but the side effects are common. Upwards to a third or half of men will have impotence or will have trouble urinating or holding on to their urine or have trouble with their bowel function. So this is not, these are not easy issues, and we can't, as I say, I think the risks of medical care, everything we do has some risk to it, and those risks are, relatively small for people who are acutely ill, But boy, when you're well, taking on some of these, accepting some of these risks may not be in your interest. The truth is, it's awfully hard to make a well person better. But right. it isn't that hard to make them worse.
Right. Well, let me ask you. Let's follow through on the logic and what would, based on the information we have,
sure,
and rational thinking about prostate in particular. So you talked about complications and so forth. But the other side of that coin is what happens to prostate cancer if it's untreated?
Yeah, if it's untreated, prostate cancer can metastasize to the bones. And that, the lifetime risk of a man developing that advanced prostate cancer that would lead to metastatic disease and death is about 3 in 100. So it's not, and let's be clear, just to show the other frame, that means 97 times out of 100, it doesn't happen to men. But it's an important cancer. It's a cancer of older men. It happens at an older age group. The research is on whether screening really helps avoid that outcome is conflicting. There have been two major randomized trials, one in the United States, which showed no benefit to prostate cancer screening. Then there's one in Europe, which did show a benefit, a small benefit, about a 20% reduction in prostate cancer mortality. Let's take the best case. Let's say the Europeans are right. We can sort of get a sense of the balance sheet there. And basically, you have to screen about 1,000 men for 10 years to help one avoid a prostate cancer death. That's a good thing. I want to be clear. If that's true, that's the European data, that would be a good thing. But it comes at a real cost. I'm not talking a dollar cost. I'm talking about a human cost. It looks like somewhere between 30 to 100 of those 1,000 men will be treated for prostate cancer unnecessarily. Wow. And about a third of them will have a long-standing side effect, impotence, incontinence, bowel and bladder problems.
Right.
And no one can tell you what the right answer to that question is, but from my standpoint, that's an awful deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
why I'm not going to be screened for prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's a gamble,
right.
And I accept, yes, maybe I'm the one out of 1,000 who could be helped, but I sure don't want to be, in that group that's 30 to 100 times more likely to be treated needlessly and suffer from that. So.
Yeah.
These are hard questions.
Yeah, we all want a risk-free option when we
right.
It doesn't exist.
And it doesn't exist. Yeah, I think one of the sort of common assumptions that to some extent I think we doctors are guilty of sort of helping the public to believe this is that all risks can be lowered. And in fact, they can't all be lowered. Some can, don't get me wrong. Don't smoke, exercise mm-hmm. more. That's really important. But when we start taking a strategy of trying to find things wrong in people who feel well, a whole bunch of unexpected things can happen, in part, as I said earlier, because we can find so many things wrong. And we start acting on them, and then sometimes we're surprised by the side effects of what happens then.
Mm-hmm. And, even physicians are trapped into this.
Absolutely.
Particularly, and I think it's important, I don't know if you're willing to try to do this, but let's take the idea like 5-year and 10-year survival rates,
yeah.
which you talk about. How
yeah.
can that mislead people yeah. into the fact that certain screening tests are saving lives? Can you try to
yeah,
help
sure.
us understand
yeah.
that
well,
issue?
Well, let me start by saying the survival statistics are I think they're the most misleading statistics we have in medicine. And unfortunately, and even without talking about the statistic itself, just the survivor story is a very powerful one that you see in the media. You see people who, have undergone breast or prostate cancer screening and they're doing fine. And this is a very, very powerful story. I wish all those people were helped. And I really hate to have to say this, but most breast and prostate cancer survivors are actually much more likely to have been overdiagnosed and treated needlessly than they are to actually have been helped by the test. And yet we interpret every survivor story as being a good news story, when in fact it may be, it's much more likely to represent a harm. And so that leads to a real paradox. You know, the more overdiagnosis a screening test causes, the more survivors there are out there, the more likely it is that people have heard a survivor story or know a survivor. And ironically, the more popular a screening test becomes. That's a real paradox for us, you know, that, that this presumption that everyone who's a survivor has been helped by the test, when in fact, you know, it's much more likely they've been harmed by it. And the same's true, and that messes up all the statistics. And the simplest way to say this, you know, at least from my standpoint, is, you know, you imagine if you diagnosed every American as having cancer, guess what? Survival rates would skyrocket. But that doesn't mean anything good has happened.
The other issue that I like to, and I was trying to explain this to my one of my daughters and my wife the other day, is the lead time bias issue in survival. I mean, to me, I thought that was, as well as the overdiagnosis.
Yeah,
bias.
Sure. So this is so let's talk about a survival statistic that people might be familiar with, which is the five-year survival rate, which is asking the question, you know, what proportion of people diagnosed with cancer at time X are alive 5 years later? And when that number goes up and we hear higher survival, we all assume that death has been delayed. But in fact, as we're finding people earlier and earlier in their course, it may just reflect earlier diagnosis, not delayed death. So that becomes really complicated in terms of, boy, is higher survival a good thing? Or does that just mean we've diagnosed people earlier in the course of their disease and added time to them? So say, for example, let's say everyone died from cancer at age 70. If we diagnosed them at age 66, then they've only lived 4 years. But if we, and so they have, their five-year survival would be zero. But if we diagnose them at age 60, then they live 10 years, even if they still die at 70. Nothing's changed, but the five-year survival rate's gone way up because you've advanced the time of diagnosis, not necessarily delayed the time of death.
Yeah. And many cancers are present for a long time before you know you have any symptoms.
That's right. And one of the things we're realizing now is, of course, we can find early forms of cancer in a lot of people, particularly in the breast, prostate, and thyroid glands.
And I appreciate, and I want to make sure everybody hears you say, you're not against doing things when you're sick and so forth.
Absolutely not.
And but there's also an issue in my mind that there's differences in these cancers that are important. So I want to hear how you comment. So if we knew, if we had a test that could tell which was going to be in a really invasive prostate or breast cancer, how does that change things?
Yeah, so if we could really sort it all out, we know there are a lot of cancers out there. When we look hard, that there are a lot of cancers out there. And if we could perfectly sort out which ones were going to be relevant to patients and which ones were not, then maybe the whole thing would make a lot more sense. Maybe we're headed that direction, although I'll have to say the genetics community is less optimistic now than they were 10 years ago, that there would be one or two genes that would all of a sudden tell the story. And in fact, what they now recognize is, first, it's not just one or two, it's multiple. It's a very complex set of genes. And it's not just about the genes. It's also about how the human host reacts to the tumor. So it's about not just the cancer itself, it's about the ecology in which that cancer lives. And of course, the thing that's also important to know is that the worst tumors actually change their genetic makeup. That's the absolute worst form of cancer, where there's multiple different clones involved. And so, you know, you treat it with one drug and the cells that survive are the ones that are resistant to that drug, much like infectious disease resistance to antibiotics.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, the bad cancers are just really bad, and there's nothing there's nothing more to say than that. It's some people doing all the right things develop bad cancers.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me remind our listeners again. You're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest is Dr. Gilbert Welch of the Dartmouth Institute of Health Policy and Clinical Research. He's the author of his most recent book, let me put it that way, is Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. And that's what we're really talking about today, the being able to really realize that there's risks and benefits to early diagnosis, and that as much as it sounds like that's a good idea, it may cause more harm than good. And you really have to be able to sit down and think about what we're going to do with results of some of the testing. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and I'd like to say one other thing is I think we have to think hard about exactly what we mean by health. I think it's more than health is more than avoiding death. You know, health is also a state of mind. It's a sense of well-being. It's a sense of resilience. And ironically, I think one of the things we can do as a system, if we're not careful, is undermine that sense of resilience and strength that really is health. And so we have to be attentive to not sort of weaken the population's sense of well-being. And I think to some extent that's going on now.
If you've got questions or comments about what you're hearing today, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Let's switch gears and just talk briefly about another cancer that we hear so much about, and another one which the United States Preventive Services Task Force has made some changes, which got lots of news, and that's the breast cancer and the recommendations for mammography. Can you talk us through the reasoning on those changes?
Well, I think, and again, I really don't enjoy being the bearer of this news, but I think in another decade, we're going to look back at mammography much the way we're now beginning to look at prostate cancer screening. I do want to say one thing so everyone gets some good news here. Breast cancer mortality is falling. That is great. The death rate from breast cancer is falling. But more and more, it looks like this is not about early detection. It's about better treatment. We are better at treating breast cancer than we were 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, our breast cancer screening approach has gotten more and more aggressive over the last 30 years, looking for smaller and smaller abnormalities with screening mammography. And I want to stop here for just a second to be clear that we're talking about doing mammograms in women who have no lumps. Women who have a lump should have a diagnostic mammogram. It's a good test for that. So I want to be totally clear with the audience. None of us have any concerns about the use of diagnostic mammography. It's a good diagnostic test to figure out what a breast lump is. The place we're raising questions is about screening mammography, which is looking for abnormalities in women who have no knowledge of anything existing. And the reality is that technology has gotten incredibly, exquisitely sensitive. And now it can be done in three dimensions, and the image can be enhanced and enlarged through digital means. And we're now finding small microscopic tumors, particularly ductal carcinoma in situ, the earliest form of breast cancer. And the reality is we're looking too hard for breast cancer, and we're biopsying too many women, and we're finding too much breast cancer. The overdiagnosis problem exists in breast cancer. It's been clearly shown in a number of European studies, and it looks like somewhere around 1 in 3 mammographically detected cancers are overdiagnosed cancers or cancers that were never going to bother that woman.
So again, like prostate cancer, there's a lot of breast cancer that is not going to be a cause of significant health issues in women. However, once they're found, things get complicated.
Everything goes right. Once the word cancer is said, Understandably, everybody wants to act. You know, one of the things is we have to, even though I've been studying cancer for 20 years, you know, you hear the word and you have this sort of textbook definition that you and I would have had in medical school, a tumor that, the natural history of which is death. And that's one definition of cancer. Of course, there's a very different definition, and that's what the pathologist uses, which is how individual cells and maybe collections of cells look under the microscope. That's the pathologic definition of cancer. And when you and I were in training, we won't say how long ago, but it was a while ago, you know, those two definitions pretty much matched up because the only thing getting to the pathologist were things the size of baseballs. But once we start looking for really small things, all of a sudden those two definitions become very, very different. So we're really struggling with what does it mean? What does the word cancer mean? And it obviously means very different things depending on how it is found.
Let's go ahead and take our break here. It's about halfway through the program. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Our local number again is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our discussions with Dr. Gilbert Welch. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and my guest today is Dr. Gilbert Welch of the Dartmouth Institute of Health Policy and Clinical Research. He's also the author of Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. Dr. Otis Brawley was supposed to also be here. He's the Chief Medical Officer of the American Cancer Society, and he has not been able to make that today, so we apologize for those of you who may have been hoping to listen to him. However, I do think Dr. Welch and Dr. Brawley and Dr. Kimberly Allison will all be talking Thursday night, September 27th at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. About topics like this overdiagnosis issue. So you're more than happy to call and attend that lecture again. That's 4:30 to 5:30 is a book signing reception, and then the lecture is 5:30 to 7 on Thursday, September 27th at the Wendy Williamson. We've talked about cancer, and we need to make sure people understand that this involves the idea and the problem, or it relates more to just cancer as well. So I've talked to somebody on this program within the last couple of years about pre-hypertension, and we're worried more and more about where diabetes gets diagnosed. Is it the same kind of issue needs to be thought through?
Absolutely. I mean, my general interest is in our desire to find early forms of disease, and I'm asking questions about the wisdom of that approach. In cancer screening, it's about looking for earlier and earlier forms of cancer with more and more powerful tests. But it also happens in much more common garden variety diseases, where doctors define things in terms of numerical abnormalities. And the ones that I think people would find easiest to understand is like high blood pressure. Now, high blood pressure is a disease that really first became something we knew about how important it was to treat in the mid-60s when the VA did a classic randomized trial looking at people whose blood pressures, the diastolic, the lower number, was 115 to 130. I mean, really high blood pressure. That's the diastolic. That's the lower number, 115 to 130. And boy, it's really, really important to treat those people. And by the time I was in medical school, we were treating people with diastolic blood pressures greater than 100. We didn't really know whether the top number, we didn't believe the top number was important, the systolic blood pressure. But now we're down to anything over 140, over 90 being considered abnormal. In fact, some doctors are being measured in terms of what proportion of their practice has a blood pressure below 140, over 90. That's an example of doctors changing the rules. There's no question we should be treating people with really high blood pressure. But we've changed the rule about what constitutes high blood pressure over the last 20 years. And it's not just been in high blood pressure. We've changed the rules as to what constitutes high cholesterol over the last 20 years. We changed the definition of what constitutes diabetes over the last 20 years. And we've changed the definition of what constitutes osteoporosis. That's the weakening of the bone that's measured numerically in terms of a T score. In each case, we've changed the rules in the same direction, in the direction of capturing more patients as being, quote, diseased or being abnormal or as needing treatment. And, of course, there's some powerful financial incentives at work here because all these abnormalities are treated with medications, and by far the easiest way to expand a market for a medication is to expand the disease definition for which it's used. The reality is, though, these new patients with mild elevations of blood pressure, mild cholesterol elevations, mild disturbance of bone metabolism, they stand the least to gain from being treated. Why someone with really high blood pressure has a lot to gain because they're at very high risk of something bad happening. But people with mild abnormalities don't stand nearly as much to gain, and yet they face the same risks of therapy. And we kind of learned that the hard way in diabetes, where in diabetes, about 10 years ago, 8 years ago now, there was interest in trying to say anybody with an elevated blood sugar, we should be trying to get them down to normal. We should get everybody down to normal. And normal is defined in terms of a hemoglobin A1C, the so-called glycosylated hemoglobin level less than 6%. Randomized trial of that kind of intensive intervention, trying to make diabetics into normal patients, actually showed their death rate increased about 25%. And the reality is, whenever we try to lower these lower blood sugar, we can't dial it in exactly, and we take people too low, and that led to people dying unnecessarily. And we have to be really conservative and careful. It's very important to treat people at the extremes. There's no question of bad. It's bad to have very, very high blood sugar, but it's also bad to have very, very low blood sugar or very, very low blood pressure. So it's nuanced.
And this is not, I hear people, I'm just thinking, I visualize somebody out there, oh, this is just playing with statistics. I mean, it's not that. It's good data. The better the data, the better you can make decisions. And it seems to me like we're kind of catching up with the data on what we know about these early diagnostic efforts.
And I think it's recognizing that there are two tails to the problem. Yes, it's good to treat people who are highly abnormal, with really high blood pressure, really high cholesterol, and so forth. But it's also a downside if you go too far down. It's a balance. I think everyone assumes, well, more medical care is always better. No, that's not right. It makes a lot of sense for people.
We're kind of the best example of that. Yeah. We spend more than anybody by a hell of a lot. And yet we're really, really, I keep saying this, we're sinking in national comparison. International comparison.
We're about 30th in life expectancy, and yet the one place we're number one is spending money on health care. Right. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Bob, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I don't know if you can hear me okay or not, the cell connection.
Just fine.
Great. Dr. Welsh, you seem to be talking about measures of healthiness and how they've evolved in a way that doesn't necessarily improve public health. And now, essentially, it sounds like you're trying to move people back toward a more appropriate measure, and you've just recently touched on the institutional forces that may have an incentive to keep it the more refined, quote-unquote, measure that it had become. What kind of public policy changes ought to be made to regulate or restrain the incentives to move the wrong direction for healthiness?
Well, Bob, I appreciate your question. Let me answer it in sort of two parts. You know, at a broad public policy level, I think we have to really question the wisdom of fee-for-service medicine, which, of course, always rewards us doctors for doing more and more and more. It's just created a bunch of perverse incentives where physicians, you know, feel they need to do more because it's the only way they get paid to do. Their hospitals are putting pressure on them to do more, to be, quote, more productive and so forth. So that monetary incentive is one big part of the story. But there's more to it than that. And that's to try to deal with some of the true belief out there with the best of intentions that presumes that it's always better to intervene. It's always better to try to capture early abnormalities. It's always better to err on the side of treating too much. And it's not always better. And so I think we need to sort of help rebalance the public about the role of medical care. And to be clear that medical care serves a lot of good purposes when people are acutely ill, but we have to be more careful with it when we're talking about people who are well. Does that help?
So are the measures that you're doing in the epidemiology program robust enough that even people that might be skeptical can accept them as real?
Well, that's a great question, and I guess that time will tell. But I will say, you know, I've been dealing with this issue of early detection for maybe now 20 years. And I do think people are much more open to the public and the news media actually now understands that there's sort of two sides to this issue, and that early detection can be a double-edged sword. So I do think we are beginning to, one, have enough data to help explain the problem, and maybe more importantly, we're just facile enough to be able to communicate and taking the time to communicate it to the general public.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Good questions, Bob. Yeah, it was, you know, it. I had written down, why have we gotten to where we are? And I wrote down two things. One, there's increased money.
Money's always a part of the story.
And second, we've been fooled by our ideas about healthcare in the first place, which is kind of, I think, what you just said. What I would echo, since I'm a private practitioner in the private sector, that I am also have come to believe that I think the for-profit payment fee-for-service is got to change. That's probably the main reason why we spend so much more than other countries. And one of the reasons I ask is this a problem in other parts of the world. But I also think that most physicians, just like most everybody out there, are trying to do the right things.
Absolutely.
However, there's this, when you pay fee-for-service, there's always this bias that thousands of ways, I think, in my office every day where, you know, there's this subtle thing, I've got to pay the bills. It just hits you, and it adds up over and over and over and over again.
Absolutely. And I'm fond of saying, you know, the problem is much less of one of bad doctors. Yeah. Now, there are some bad doctors out there, so I don't want to deny they exist. But that's not the general problem. The general problem is good doctors working in a bad system.
Right. Yeah. So in that sense, this information that you're bringing out and others like you are helping us say, you know, you don't need a CT scan of your head because you fell off the bed.
You may not want a CT.
You don't want to know the result.
Right. Can I share a quick anecdote? And this is a doctor who told me this about his father, you know, who is a healthy 75-year-old where a physician was just doing a well checkup and felt his abdomen and thought he felt a little enlargement in his aorta. We call that an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And, you know, the doctor thought he was doing the right thing, you know, just checking an older gentleman to see if anything was wrong, and ordered an ultrasound. And the ultrasound said, the aorta is fine, but there's something wrong with the kidney. And so then he goes in and gets a CT scan of his belly to evaluate this apparent kidney lesion. And the kidney actually looked fine on the CT scan, but instead there was they found a lesion, an abnormality on his liver. Then they went ahead to biopsy that abnormality. It turned out it was a hemangioma, which is a very vascular, blood-filled, a non-cancerous lesion, but then it bled. And, he had to receive, 5-6 units of blood, was admitted to the hospital for about a week. And it turned out to be about a $70,000, well checkup. You know, these things happen, you know, where we're trying to check things and we're going too far. You know, here's a 75-year-old in good shape, and we're looking too hard at that human body. And once we find abnormalities, we feel we got to check them out. And when we check things out, eventually we bring out needles and bad things can happen.
If you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. This is not a real story. It's more of a joke along the same line, but it shows that there's another side of this, and that's the patient side of it. The guy who plays golf every week with a group of guys, and these group of guys say, you know, every time George comes here, he's got a new ache, a new pain, whatever. He's just telling me today that he went to the doctor. He had all these tests done. He says, Doc, I feel bad. I got this. The guy does all these tests and everything. And then he comes and he has the gall to tell me there's nothing wrong with me. I'm going to go get another opinion, he said.
Right.
The patient is asking us, how come I feel bad?
That's right. And we feel obliged to do something. And one of the things I think we need to work with our medical students and trainees is to open them up to the idea that every encounter doesn't need to end in a prescription for a medication or an ordering of a diagnostic test. Mm-hmm. That's not good medicine. Mm-hmm. There ought to be some discrimination going on. Discrimination in a very positive sense, trying to sort out who will really benefit from intervention and who will not.
All right, here's an email. This is where the rubber meets the road, Dr. Welch.
Okay.
And again, you may want to say, I'm not the urologist here, and that's okay. But here's a man who has written, I'm assuming it's a man, he's trying to understand the logic of screening versus no screening. I am not second-guessing my decisions, he says, but my readings on the PSA went from 2.4 to 4.5 to 6.3 in 9 months. It seems that this is the sort of history that indicated action versus wait and see. What do you think?
Well, I am not this gentleman's physician, but I would say that is a rapidly rising PSA. Yep. Whether that's rising because there's a cancer there that's ultimately going to matter is a little bit a different question, because there are other things that make the prostate
or it could be cancer up. That's not going to do him anything.
That's right.
Right.
But this is a fast. This is a relatively fast rise in a PSA, and obviously he's already connected with the physician. physician, or else he wouldn't be having these tests. And I would defer to his current physician. He's made the decision to participate in screening. I think once you're in, that's the point where you want to have a trusted relationship with a physician you like.
Mm-hmm. So you need a lot of information. You got to know what's the risks and benefits of doing stuff and not doing stuff. So the best advice that we can give this emailer is to go back and have a deep conversation about what your options are.
Absolutely. I think that's right.
Okay. Roger, you're on line one.
Good afternoon.
How you doing?
My topic is pancreatic cancer. I have been diagnosed. I had bile duct infections or blockage for 6 months, and then they finally opened me up and found that I had a significant cancer attached to the bile duct. So at the present time, I'm in the process of trying to figure out what to do next. We have contacted the Hutch in Seattle, and we're waiting to hear back from them. So I think one of the options is they seem to feel that they may be able to remove this by surgery, and I'd just like your opinions on that.
Well, Roger, first let me say I'm sorry. This is a symptom. You have a bile duct obstruction. This is obviously a growth that needs to be dealt with. And I will say I did some of my training at the Hutch. I think they're great folks down there. I don't think I can tell you much more since I don't look at your scans and so forth, and don't have a full piece of information here, but I do want to, say I'm sorry, and I do hope you pursue. This is a place where it's good to have medical care.
Well, we're just, we don't know what to do next, and we've been given probably a couple of years unless they could remove it, and so we're between the rock and the hard place, as they say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I hope you find some physicians that listen to you and help you chart your own course.
Well, I've seen a number of them now, I can tell you. And I think they're all good people. I appreciate them, and thanks so much for your comment.
Well, yeah. Best of luck to you,
good
sir.
Good luck, Roger. Let me remind everybody also, if you go to Line One, Your Health Connection, or at alaskapublic.org, I should say, and go to the Line One Connection for today's program, there will be several links. One to Dr. Welch's book, Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health, so you can get that book. Also, we've commented before that he'll be speaking Thursday evening at the Wendy Williamson from 5:30 to 7. Also, there's a link to a couple of videos that Dr. Welch has done that I have found on the internet, one talking about overdiagnosis, it's a long one, and one about pros and cons of mammography and PSA testing. Both of them are fairly recent and take into some of the new recommendations. So there's more than just re-listening to this program if you want to get more information. Now, Dr. Welch, here's another email, and this gets to kind of the crux of some of the issues you're talking about. This lady has written and says, I had a LEEP, L-E-E-P, procedure done when I was 19. Now, 13 years later, my current doctor tells me this procedure is very rarely done and most likely should not have been done. Can you tell me about the new guidelines for annual PAP and treatment of the abnormal Pap smear? And this is an issue that you've discussed in your book as well.
Yeah, but honestly, I'm not up to speed on the most recent Pap smear recommendation. All I can say is, in general, the OB-GYN community have been backing off what was a test that was done in almost every woman every year, including my mother up until age 85. They now recognize that that it can be much more targeted, particularly with the additional information of the human papillomavirus status of the patient. So I'm not prepared off the cuff to state the current recommendation, but I will say this is another area you know, like breast and prostate cancer screening, where actually the recommendations are getting more conservative, in part because they understand the problem of overdiagnosis and overtreatment.
Mm-hmm. So we're learning.
We are learning, and I think we are changing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's good news.
Yeah. Depression, the whole psychological side of things, we haven't talked about much, but is the same. I mean, you know, people complain that, oh, yeah, depression is now much broader, bipolar illness, things have gotten spread out some. Is that worth mentioning?
It's certainly worth mentioning. I specifically stay away from it in my book. Because it's a little bit different. I mean, the formal definition of overdiagnosis is making a diagnosis in an individual of an abnormality that will never cause symptoms or death. It will never be relevant to the patient. When we start moving into the psychological areas, it becomes very hard to determine what constitutes a symptom. So these are people who are having some experience that takes them to the doctor's office. This is as opposed to inviting people who feel perfectly fine in for us to examine them thoroughly to see if we can't find something wrong. So I think it is slightly different. And so I don't really deal with it in the book, nor am I prepared to say a lot more about it now.
All right. I'm a lumper, which has some bad connotations as opposed to a splitter.
I'm a lumper too.
I wouldn't be a good accountant. Yeah. I don't think. In fact, I know I wouldn't be. Yeah. So what I wrote down is something that I'm asking you to tell me I'm wrong or that I'm lumped too much. But I'm trying to get people to remember things that there's always, and this is something I tell patients all the time. There's always a risk of doing something, and there's a risk of not doing something, and that's where we really got to balance our things. And right now, what we're doing is we're learning a lot about the risk of doing things that we need to really put into some perspective.
Yeah, and I think first, I don't think you've lumped too much. I think what I'm encouraging people to think about, and I think people do understand that there are risks to doing things, and they're familiar with being concerned about side effects of treatment. You know, that has been something that the public, I think, has understood for a while. What I'm encouraging them to expand that to recognize their side effects of testing. I think people have sort of thought, well, a test, there's no downside to knowing. But in fact, there are. The truth is, you know, our tests can start a whole train of events that become very difficult to stop. And you know, our diagnostic technologies do some really good things. I mean, the advent of, you know, CT scans, they've been really helpful in treating sick patients. That said, I would never want to go in for a total body CT while I was feeling well, because I know we'd unearth a bunch of little things that then I would worry about. And so I think, and that some doctors would think we should pursue. So I think that idea that you say of being cautious about intervening needs to be expanded to include testing. Mm-hmm. That there are side effects of testing, and those side effects include overdiagnosis.
I think you'll maybe appreciate this more than I. We got an email that says, "Thank you, Dr. Woodard and Dr. Welch, for lowering my blood pressure."
Oh,
great program.
So. Well, thank you so much. I mean, and of course, this is, in some ways, one of the things I am concerned about, where we introduce too much dis-ease into this society, literally dis-ease, by, you know, making people worried about things that they'd be better off not worrying about.
So I wrote down as another question towards the end of the program, I thought it would be the best time to ask it, how can patients improve their interactions with the healthcare system? Based on today's discussion, what's a patient to do?
Well, I hope patients develop a little bit of healthy skepticism about early diagnosis. And I'm not saying cynicism here. I'm saying healthy skepticism, and that to recognize that it is not always in their interest to be looking for things to be wrong. and having that balance and sharing it with your physician, by the way. I mean, telling your physician. I think most of docs, and myself included, sort of assume that patients always want diagnostic tests. And I think for patients who now understand the two sides of the issue, if you are, if it feels right to be a little bit more conservative while you're feeling well, you need to communicate that with your doctor. And you may be surprised, pleasantly surprised, that the your physician is totally open to hearing that message. I think the another thing they should do when doctors are suggesting tests, they ought to ask the doctor why he or she is suggesting the test. And one question to ask is, are they being measured on it? I mean, one of the things that's happening in our new system is doctors are being, they're being held to certain standards of so-called performance measures, some of which I think are hugely debatable about whether they represent healthcare quality or whether they just represent an easy thing to measure. And I think it's a very reasonable question to ask your doctor why they're recommending the test, and are they under pressure to have you do it? That tells you something.
This has been enjoyable. I wish we could talk more often. I very much appreciate your taking the time to be with us today.
Well, it's been wonderful to come here and to be back in the great state of Alaska.
Good luck going to Bethel.
And, I'm looking forward to it.
Hope you get back by
Thursday. Yeah, okay. I hope I'm back by Thursday. Yeah.
My guest today has been Dr. Gilbert Welch of the Dartmouth Institute of Health Policy and Clinical Research, and his most recent book is Overdiagnosed, Making People Sick in the Pursuit of Health. I'd recommend it to anyone interested in the topics that we've discussed today, and particularly if you're interested in where we're going in healthcare in this country. It'll help put some perspective on it as well. Next week, let me also remind people that you can continue the conversation, as I usually recommend each time at the end of the program, by going to KSKA and finding the link to Facebook, where we'll continue to keep some conversation going on that. Next week, also October 1st, we're going to be back, and we'll have our guest, Dr. Dale Bratzler. He's professor of the Department of Health Administration and Policy and associate dean of the College of Public Health at the University of Oklahoma. He's a national expert on healthcare quality improvement, and we'll be discussing that as well as reducing patient harm in healthcare. Perhaps we'll have some issues from today's program to discuss with him at that time. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack was our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.